Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll learn more about the Bucks for Brains program and the potential lack of funding it faces this year. First, Kentucky lawmakers will soon head to Frankfort for the start of the 2008 legislative session. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh takes a look at some of the issues awaiting action against the backdrop of a bleak financial forecast.
The 2008 session of the Kentucky General Assembly begins on January 8th. It will be a budget session because the state approves two-year budgets in even-numbered years. The state has a new governor, Democrat Steve Beshear, and new governors traditionally deliver a budget address to a joint session of the legislature by the 15th day of the session. Governor Beshear will deliver his on January 28th. Governors also traditionally deliver a State of the Commonwealth address to a joint session, and Beshear will deliver that on January 14th. Governor Beshear was sworn in on December 11th, and he used his inaugural address to announce one of his top priorities for the 08 session, ethics reform. Another of Beshear's top priorities is to let the people decide whether casino gambling should be allowed in the state. That would come in the form of a constitutional amendment, and Beshear's office is already drafting a bill. House Speaker Jody Richards has agreed to help Beshear win passage of casino legislation, and its chances in the Democrat-controlled House appear favorable. But the Republican-controlled Senate could be a harder sell. Senate Budget Chief Charlie Borders says casinos are not the financial panacea many believe them to be. He says initially they bring in a lot of revenue, but what happens a few years down the road?
Where were those dollars going to prior to our establishing gambling? I would suggest they might be buying school supplies, paying the rent, things of that nature. You take those out of the economy in the out years would really have detrimental downtimes.
Lexington Senator Ernesto Scorsone says one thing working in favor of casino proponents is dwindling state revenues.
I think it's a lot more appealing to folks because they see it as a way to maybe have some additional revenue that we wouldn't have otherwise. I think so. But I think the message that Beshear emphasizes, let people vote on it, I think that still resonates quite well with people. And more, I think there's more support for that.
But even if a casino gambling amendment passed next year, it wouldn't go before the voters until November. And even if the voters said yes, it likely would be a year or more before the state would see any new revenue from casinos. So lawmakers like Representative Kathy Stein of Lexington are expecting Governor Beshear to offer a lean budget next month.
We've got to solve the budgetary problem, that we don't have as much money as we thought. We have more expenditures than we thought.
House Health and Welfare Committee Chairman Tom Burch of Louisville says lawmakers are also staring at huge deficits in the Medicaid program.
If the projections are right, we're about $300 million short in it or better. In order to meet that commitment, then we have to use our rainy day money to come up with the $112 or $14 million we need to offset that.
State pension plans are also bleeding red ink. Senator Borders says lawmakers should have addressed the problem in the last session, as the Senate had urged.
It's something we must deal with because for us to have the dollars, Tony, that we need for education, corrections, transportation, and those type of things, we're going to have to deal with this runaway pension health care issue. If we don't, there'll be no dollars for these other areas.
Literally hundreds of issues will be addressed in the upcoming session, from abolishing the death penalty to requiring child booster seats. From mandating paper trails for voting machines to requiring physical activity in schools. Once they begin, lawmakers will have 60 days to get their work done before the session adjourns on April 15th. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Still to come in Studio 619, Gabe Bullard learns more about a U.S. Supreme Court case from Indiana that deals with providing identification at the polls. The Kentucky General Assembly has a lot on its plate in the upcoming legislative session that starts Tuesday. As Stephanie Sanders reports, some post-secondary education leaders fear one of their most successful programs won't get another round of funding because of concerns about the state's tight budget.
Dr. Scott Whittemore is removing what looks like a big metal toolbox from a large liquid nitrogen container. Inside are the cells that are used by his lab to research spinal cord injuries and neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis. The Kentucky Spinal Cord Injury Research Center opened its doors in 2001 and not only conducts research, but also offers surgical treatment and rehabilitation. About 200 people are currently on the waiting list to participate in either research or rehab at the center, where Dr. Whittemore is the scientific director.
This center would not be here were it not for Bucks for Brains.
Bucks for Brains is the more commonly used name for the Research Challenge Trust Fund. It was created by the General Assembly in 1997 to help the state's universities create endowed chairs. The goal was to increase intellectual capital, specifically in areas of research, by attracting people who are at the top of their fields to Kentucky. So, for example, if the University of Louisville gets $1 million from Bucks for Brains, U of L has to raise $1 million in matching funds from private donors, and that $2 million is used to help lure the brightest minds in the country to Louisville. But the General Assembly has to periodically reauthorize state funding for the program. In 1998, $110 million was put into Bucks for Brains. In 2000, another $120 million, and another $120 million in 2002. But nothing since then.
Most people don't put new gas into their tank until the tank has run dry. The tank didn't run dry until fairly recently, but the tank is completely dry now, and I think the legislature will be very interested in refilling that tank because the program has been so successful.
That's Brad Cowgill. He's the interim president of the Council on Postsecondary Education, but he's only been in that role since September. Before that, he was the state's budget director. He understands better than most people what goes into creating a budget, especially a tight one. But the CPE is asking the General Assembly for the authorization of another $200 million for Bucks for Brains this year.
I tell people that not only can we afford it, we almost can't afford not to.
He's talking about monetary returns from the investment to Bucks for Brains. At the Spinal Cord Injury Research Center, they've used $13 million in Bucks for Brains money to bring in top scientists. In return, they've secured more than $45 million in federal grants to conduct research. Bucks for Brains money also goes to the University of Kentucky and the state's regional universities. More than $700 million has been spent on attracting leaders in a variety of fields. Dr. Whittemore says it's money well spent.
It is very difficult to attract those types of individuals to leave their institutions on the East Coast or the West Coast and come to Louisville without the attraction of the endowed chairs that are generated from Bucks for Brains.
And the work of the Spinal Cord Injury Research Center is still growing. Dr. Scott Whittemore hopes to bring in at least another five or six endowed chairs with the goal of doubling the center's scientific reach over the next 5 years. He says this is the time for the General Assembly to send a strong message.
And to renew that commitment is certainly recognized across the country as being very innovative and very forward-thinking in terms of supporting research as a primary goal of the legislature.
For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
The 2008 Indiana General Assembly convenes this week. This is a 30-day even year session at the Indianapolis State House. I spoke with Matt Tully, political columnist for the Indianapolis Star, about issues facing Hoosier lawmakers when they get down to work Tuesday. It's no secret this time the agenda will be topped by property tax reform, right?
Absolutely. That's the one thing that must get accomplished this year for the governor, for the legislators. Everyone knows that this year is really lining up to be the year which some really important work could be done, because you have voters eager for change, you have politicians understanding that they need to react and do something, not just a quick fix like they've done so many times in the past, where they offer a rebate to homeowners or provide a little bit of relief. They know they need something that's going to stand the test of time and really reform the system.
What caused tax bills to go up so much this time?
Boy, it was just a whole bunch of factors. It stretches back to the 1990s court case in which they changed the way that homes are assessed for tax value in Indiana. In the past, basically, in short, what happened is the older your house got, the less its value became for tax bills, which, you know, is counter to the way it works in real estate. As time goes on, homes get more valuable, but you had very expensive homes that were old paying very low tax bills, while newer homes were paying higher tax bills. So they changed that, and they said, no, you have to start basing your tax assessments on market value. And that's been a process. It started in 2003. They got about halfway there. They did it again this year. They reassessed, and they got homes closer to their home value. So by doing that, a lot of homes that had their assessments increased, which means higher tax bills, On top of that, local government spending, school spending, reduced assistance from the state, all these things added up to increase tax bills.
And some bills went up, what, 20, 24%, something like
that?
Well,
that's the state average, actually. Some bills went up well over 100%. Wow. I live here in Indianapolis in an older neighborhood. In my neighborhood, for instance, you hear plenty of people talk about their bill going up 80, 90, 100, 150%.
And this prompted some demonstrations up in your area.
Correct? You know, unlike anything I've ever seen in Indiana, off and on I've covered Indiana politics since the early 90s. And never have I seen voters, residents come out like they did this past summer. They held rallies on the governor's lawn. They went to city council meetings and protested. They held signs. They staged petitions. They created websites. Here in Indianapolis, it had an amazing impact in that the mayor of Indianapolis, who was seen as a sure thing for reelection, who outspent his opponent roughly 20-1, lost reelection, and probably the biggest upset, at least in Indianapolis history, perhaps in the state's history, largely because of the tax issue.
Are there a lot of proposals out there to fix the problem?
There is. There are, obviously. The governor has the main one, and what he wants to do is he wants to increase the state sales tax by 1%, use that and other means, such as reduced spending, to take the burden off property taxes. He would also put constraints on how high property tax bills could go up in the future, referendums for local government spending, that kind of thing. So that's the leading idea, but we're starting to see a lot of lawmakers come up with their own ideas. You have a faction that is saying, no, we have to get rid of property taxes, which most people, most economists will tell you, you could do it, but you would have to raise other taxes so high that it would really hurt the state.
I see. Well, moving on to another issue, could we see another effort this time to pass an amendment that would ban same-sex marriages?
I don't think it's going to happen. You're going to see an effort. Certainly, it's a powerful political issue, and Republicans, especially in the House, are going to push it. They don't control the House. The House Democrats have a plan to kill it, and they probably will. And then what that means is that they go back to square one, because the way Indiana's amendment rules work, you have to pass a question such as, do you want to ban same-sex marriage, in two separately elected legislatures. So that's a four-year process. They passed it in the previous elected legislature back about 3 years ago. If they don't do it this year, they have to start from scratch, which means that it would take at least four more years to go through that process.
Has there been any polling of Hoosiers, how they feel about this?
Yeah, we've polled at my newspaper, and with each poll we do, it has less and less support. And our most recent poll showed it about even, which was dramatically down from where it was five years ago. It doesn't seem to be the potent political issue that it was just 3 or 4 years ago. A lot of political scientists will tell you, with the war, with the economy, with a lot of these issues that have dominated in recent years, the social issues have kind of fallen off the table as far as being the hot issue that they were not too long ago. That said, here in Indiana, there is a strong contingent that will come to the State House and rally, and there are plenty of lawmakers who will push the issue. But with property taxes, I think everything else is going to be swamped as far as attention and time this year.
Well, as you mentioned, this is not a budget session, but how are the state's finances looking at this point?
A little rocky, along with much of the country. The state recently announced its budget, its revenue forecast, and it was a lot lower than the governor had predicted and hoped. So it means he ordered, for instance, in state spending, he ordered cuts. I think it was 5% every department had to trim from their budget. That leaves a lot less money for things like property tax relief and things like that. The jobs numbers, our unemployment rate is lower than a lot of states, and we've had some pretty big successes in winning factories such as the Honda plant, things like that. But we've also had a lot of manufacturing, especially plants, close and jobs have been lost, and the wage rates have not gone up the way a lot of people hoped they would under the current governor. So it's been a mixed bag. There have been successes, but it certainly hasn't improved by leaps and bounds.
Governor Mitch Daniels is seeking re-election. Are there any serious challengers out there?
Yes. The most serious challenger is that the governor remains very unpopular in certain parts of the state. And things like enacting daylight saving time and leasing out the Indiana Toll Road and certain ways that he ran the government have turned a lot of people off around the state. So he comes to the election vulnerable. Just because of the things that he's done and the way it's been perceived in some parts of the state, especially up north and down south. Democrats have two candidates running in the primary, Jim Schellinger, a businessman here in Indianapolis, and Jill Long Thompson, a former congresswoman from up north. And that was expected to be kind of an easy primary for Jim Schellinger, but it's really turning out to be a battle. And there have been signs recently that it's starting to get heated, if not nasty. And I think what you're going to see over the next 4 months is those two Democrats really go at it. And right now it's probably a toss-up to see who challenges Daniels. The fear for Democrats is that their candidates will beat each other up and spend so much money that they'll be wounded going into the fall election.
Mm. And while I have you here, Matt, Indiana will be front and center coming up next Wednesday at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes. The voter ID law, which was passed a couple of years ago, Democrats in the state have been highly critical of that law, saying that it disenfranchises especially poor and elderly people. They haven't proved that a lot. They've struggled to come up with examples of people who have been turned away at the polls and that sort of thing. But it will be interesting to see what the High Court says about it.
Okay, Matt Tully, political columnist for the Indianapolis Star. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Indiana is one of several states, including Georgia and Florida, that require all voters to present a photo ID at the polls. In states where such laws exist or are proposed, a partisan battle typically ensues. Republicans claim the law stops voter fraud, while Democrats claim it disenfranchises certain members of society. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments over Indiana's law. Associate Professor Michael Pitts of Indiana University's School of Law talked with Gabe Bullard about the case.
With the case going to the Supreme Court, it sounds like it's a partisan issue. So could you please explain what both sides' arguments are for and against the law?
Well, sure. It's definitely a partisan issue, and it's a partisan issue nationwide. Similar bills requiring voters to present government-issued photo identification have been sent to state legislatures all over the country. At least 10 of them have been considered in the past few years, and about 95% of Republicans in those state legislators have voted for the law, and only 2% of Democrats have, are the latest statistics that I've seen. And the divide is basically whether or not, and the case is about whether or not, presenting a government-issued photo identification in order to vote is a severe burden on voters, and whether or not it discriminates against certain classes of voters, like low-income people and minorities, people who tend to vote for the Democratic Party.
And what's the argument and how that would work against those voters?
Well, the argument is that people who are at the lower end of the income scale are less likely to, say, drive cars and have a driver's license readily at their disposal, and therefore will not have easy access to the sorts of government-issued photo identification. Mostly what we're talking about here is driver's licenses or state identification cards, that they won't have access to these sorts of identification, and thus they won't be able to vote.
And so if someone doesn't have this identification, how would they go about getting the photo ID?
Well, the state will give out free photo identification cards to people who, say, can't afford it. But what they'd have to do is they'd have to go to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, and they'd have to collect their birth certificates and the other documents that are required in order to get a state identification card and present them to the officials. And that's not an easy task.
There's a fee associated if they don't have a birth certificate, correct? Will that be waived?
Well, the fee for the state identification card will be waived. What is not necessarily going to be waived is any fee to get any of the underlying documents in order to get that card, namely any fee for a birth certificate. And, you know, people might need their birth certificate, not necessarily even from the state of Indiana, but say from the state of Massachusetts. And there are no waivers for the birth certificates, and that is the number one sort of underlying document where there will be a fee that has been presented in this case.
All right, and this is an Indiana case that's going to the Supreme Court, but what effects will this have in other states?
Well, it could have an effect. Georgia has a very similar law. Arizona has passed a similar law. Florida has passed a similar law. So it could have some ramifications for voter identification laws in other states. And certainly if the state wins, you would expect that Republicans and state legislatures around the country will continue to push for more and more of these laws throughout the nation, and Congress will undoubtedly take up this issue too. There are bills pending in Congress both for and against the photo identification at the polls.
All right, and is there, you mentioned the other states that have the similar law, is there a precedent for this nationally through Congress or the court?
There is no precedent. The court is basically operating on a blank slate here. There was a case that came up from the state of Arizona in November of 2006, but the court, it came up on a very procedural, technical issue. And so the court is operating on a blank slate here, and who knows what they will do.
So do you have a prediction at all for how the court
I have going? No prediction. I mean, the person to watch, when it comes to the election law in the Supreme Court, you just really don't know what the court is going to do. I would expect the court to be sort of with the conservative block of four and with the liberal block of four. There's sort of probably four safe votes on either side. Justice Kennedy would seemingly be, as usual, the wild card in this case. And what Justice Kennedy might do is anybody's guess, I think.
That was Associate Professor Michael Pitts with Indiana University School of Law. He spoke with WFPL's Gabe Bullard. More information on the Indiana law and the Supreme Court can be found at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer looks back on trends in charitable giving during 2007. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, Kristen Espelon looks ahead to the major environmental issues of 2008. First, in this country, giving to nonprofits is practically a holiday tradition, prompted by the season's suggestion to think of those in need. Louisville's nonprofit sector did not suffer from the mortgage crisis or the volatile stock market in 2007, but nonprofit organizations are keeping a wary eye on 2008. Elizabeth Kramer surveyed several Louisville nonprofits about the trends they saw last year and the outlook for the new year.
The end of the year brought many things, including pitches from nonprofit organizations reminding you to give before January 1st so that you could deduct your donations on your 2007 tax forms. Several Louisville organizations, from St. Vincent de Paul to the Metro United Way, say last year's fundraising efforts brought in more checks during November and December than they saw at the same time in 2006, and they are optimistic about this year's fundraising efforts, at least in the short term. That sentiment falls in line with what other fundraisers have reported across the country, as illustrated in a report by Indiana University's Center on Philanthropy. Patrick Rooney is head of research at the center.
Fundraisers today are slightly more optimistic about the fundraising environment than they were 6 months ago or a year ago. At the same time, they're not very much more optimistic about the future.
The roots of this optimism stem from recent history in fundraising. While nonprofits on the whole struggled following the 2001 terrorist attacks and an economic downturn, they saw more pennies in their pockets after 2005, as donations began to increase. Part of this increase emerged after nonprofits began cultivating several specific strategies. One was matching gifts, where a donor agrees to put up a large sum of money if others contribute enough to match that amount. In 2007, the Fund for the Arts got a $50,000 conditional pledge from former Brown Foreman CEO Owsley Brown and his wife, Christy. The conditions? Board members of area arts organizations had to increase their 2007 contributions over the previous year, and those increases had to add up to at least $50,000. After the fund put out the call in December, contributions exceeded the $50,000 goal. Also, Jewish Family and Vocational Service recently used a $25,000 gift that other donors matched and exceeded by $12,000. The other strategy was getting people involved in volunteer activities to experience the actual services nonprofit organizations provide. Wendy Adams is Vice President of Marketing and Communications at Metro United Way.
We are finding that when people are able to get engaged with their community and see the impact that their donations are having, that they're much more likely to give.
Adams says many people volunteer through workplace-related activities, like one of the largest local fundraising projects of 2007, Yum's World Hunger Relief Week. Held in October, it raised money for the United Nations efforts to combat hunger internationally. Locally, 1,800 Yum employees volunteered their time at almost 50 organizations in the metropolitan area that work to combat hunger. Metro United Way matched those volunteers with the organizations, and those volunteers later sent in donations. However, some local fundraisers recognize possible trouble on the horizon. Again, Wendy Adams.
Where the housing market had affected people initially was in lower-income areas, and we have seen that that has stretched out now to middle-class homes and families.
Adams says this situation would not necessarily mean a decrease in donations, but it could cause expenses to increase for the social service agencies that serve people who have fallen on hard times. Nonetheless, most nonprofit professionals are confident that local organizations can weather an economic storm. One is Kevin Connolly, the CEO of the Center for Nonprofit Excellence.
I think most agencies are going to come through this pretty well.
Connolly credits local nonprofits with applying creative ideas to raising money and with involving the community. He recounts how Wayside Mission once requested people to bring in their favorite holiday dishes to serve in its kitchen. After the health department told the mission this would violate health regulations, Wayside modified its idea. It asked people to bring their recipes and ingredients to the kitchen and help prepare the food. Connolly and others expect that local nonprofits will be able to build on that creative legacy in 2008. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
. 2007 put the environment in the spotlight all over Louisville and Kentucky. 2008 could deliver even more of a green focus. WFPL's Kristen Espelon has the snapshot of what environmental leaders see on the horizon.
This year, we may get deeper into the nitty-gritty of climate change, the effects of it unfolding right here in our backyards, and how Kentucky is or isn't responding. If climate change went from a question mark to an exclamation point last year, this year it's on everyone's agenda, period. The Sierra Club's Steve Henry says his organization, for instance, will be partnering with Louisville to help the city make good on a nationwide climate change pact.
Louisville participates in the U.S. Conference of Mayors Agreement on Climate Change, and that's an excellent blueprint for how a community can address climate change. There's so much that can be done at the local level.
Henry says the club also plans to keep coal-fired power plants in its sights.
Trying to ensure that power that comes from coal-fired power plants is much more efficient and that the older plants are either retired or, if they're to be replaced, with the best available technologies.
Climate change is also top of mind for the operator of many of those plants, E.ON. E.ON's environmental director, Sharon Dodson, says this year the power company has lots of environmental construction projects underway, including retrofitting plants with several pollution controls.
The number one pollution control device that we've really been focused on has been putting on what's called a scrubber, and that scrubber removes the sulfur dioxide from the emissions going out the stack. So by the end of 2009, we'll pretty much be fully scrubbed across our entire fleet.
That could help prevent acid rain. The work mainly ensures compliance with federal regulations, but it doesn't change the fact, Dodson says, that coal will continue to be the fuel of choice.
The problem for us here in Kentucky is you know, our resource truly is coal. Renewable resources, the opportunity there for us is minimal.
Still, Dodson says E.ON is planning to add enough renewable energy sources to its portfolio to equal 750 megawatts. That's about what a large coal-fired power plant produces. And the company could need all the renewables it can find if Congress passes global warming legislation. She expects it this year. So does her counterpart in an entirely different industry, alcoholic beverages. Brown-Forman's Sherilyn Patrick oversees efforts to help the company reduce its environmental impact, from the energy used in office buildings to the water used in distilleries. Patrick says the multi-billion-dollar beverage company completed a study of each facility's carbon footprint in the U.S. and Canada, and this year they'll do Europe and Mexico. But Patrick says the untapped opportunity this year may lie elsewhere.
We focused pretty heavily on production and pre-production, but, you know, we might have some opportunities in how we engage with the consumer, whether it's what materials we use for our displays, how we do a promotional event,
or even how they encourage customers to recycle bottles. Both Brown-Forman and E.ON see 2008 as the year when they not only get greener producing their products, but appeal to their customers to get greener too. They're not alone in a business community that's beginning to see responding to climate change as not only morally imperative, but financially imperative. And addressing climate change has been topping and will continue to top the list of concerns, of course, of more than just businesses. City agencies, nonprofit environmental groups, educational institutions, and even individual citizens will all be trying out solutions. And everyone will be learning as they go. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espelon.
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with documentary filmmaker David Grubin. His film airs this week on PBS. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll learn more about a new historic discovery aboard the Belle of Louisville. First, in the 1700s, the first Jews immigrated to the Dutch colonial city of New Amsterdam. More than 350 years later, New Amsterdam is New York and home to the world's largest Jewish population outside Israel. And Jews didn't just settle in New York. So how did American Jews go from an isolated few to millions located nationwide and in all strata of American life? WFPL's Robin Fisher talked with filmmaker David Grubin about his new PBS series, The Jewish Americans, which traces the history of American Jews from the beginning to the present and what it means to be an American Jew.
I watched it and loved it. I thought it was really great. I was interested, though, you've already done one film, one series on immigrants in America. Why go back and focus just on the Jews?
Well, I actually think that this series, while it focuses on the Jews, is really for every American, because the Jewish American story is a quintessentially American story. What it's really about is the struggle of one tiny minority to make its way into the American mainstream and at the same time hold on to its identity. That is, if you're a Jew in America for 350 years, you've wanted to be a part of America. Jews have embraced America. At the same time, they want to maintain their identity. They want to hold on to their heritage. That tension between identity and adaptation is familiar to every minority, to every immigrant who's ever come to America. That's why this story is going to resonate with everyone.
Well, you know, I think that is especially true with something that I guess never occurred to me, was that the Jewish story is so much the American story because they came here originally to escape religious persecution.
Yes, well, the Jews the Jews came here first in 1654. Most people don't realize that their history goes way back to the beginning of American history. And they were actually escaping the Inquisition, which was on its way to Portugal, to Brazil, who had been Brazil had been conquered by the Portuguese. So they were not coming directly from Europe. They were coming from Brazil. 23 Jews were escaping the Inquisition, and they ended up in New Amsterdam, which is today New York City, and that was the first Jewish settlement.
Tell me a little bit about how a project like this comes together. You have some wonderful photographs that are used throughout the series, and then, of course, experts, both whom you both see on screen and you hear off screen. And how does something like this begin and then come together?
Well, I always begin by writing a script, and that is a solitary experience for me. I'm really working on my own, and I try to imagine what the series is going to look like. Once I have the script, I can get a team on board, and the team begins to search the archives for photographs and for motion pictures. What's interesting in this case is that we went through 250 archives all over the country. The Jewish experience took place all over America. It isn't just in a few cities. So 250 archives, and we brought in 10,000 photographs. At the same time, we brought in 150 hours of film, and I began doing interviews, and I interviewed over 100 people. I've never interviewed so many people for a film. And the film became an ensemble of voices woven together with the photographs and the archival material.
Well, the stories are fascinating. I was especially taken with the stories of, I guess you would call them, unexpected places to find Jewish Americans. Mm-hmm. The peddlers, the mm-hmm. going out west, yeah. And then I believe there was a woman that ended up owning a hotel.
Right, Anna Solomon. You see, one of the things we were trying to do in the series was to break through the stereotype that Jews really live in the East, mostly in New York City. And in fact, Jews, you can find Jewish Americans in every state of the Union, and that's because the Jewish experience was part of the American experience, so that when Americans go west, Jews go west, and the Southerners had slaves, Jews had slaves who were Southerners. You see, that the idea is to say Jews really were very much like other Americans, so that when you see a picture of a Jewish sheriff with a gun, and you know, why that looks, he looks so Jewish. Yeah, but he's also an American.
Well, you know, they also have had the American experience, too, of the prejudice.
Yes. I mean, America has been very, very good to Jewish Americans, and been very good to minorities, but there's also this prejudice that Americans have toward the outsider, and immigrants have always had to make their way into American life. For Jews, anti-Semitism was real and palpable, and in times of stress, in times of depression or war, it broke out with a kind of virulence that was frightening. You see it during the Civil War especially, and of course in the 20s and 30s here in America, with rallies that remind you of rallies that you might have seen in Nazi Germany.
Well, you know, I have a question about the anti-Semitism in America. Was it, has it stood alone, or has it been somehow connected to world events? I know anti-Semitism waxes and wanes, for instance, in Russia and in the Soviet Union. And will sort of it make its way here? Does it make its way from here somewhere else, or is it just sort of isolated pockets?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think what's interesting about Jews here in America is that Americans both are puzzled by them and ignorant of them, and that can lead to anti-Semitism because it can lead to terrible stereotypes and fear. And at the same time, Jews are the people of the book, that is the Old Testament. That's the Jewish book. And so there's a kind of curiosity about Jews and recognition that the Old Testament is a part of the Bible. and is a part of the heritage of a Judeo-Christian civilization. So there's this tension about Jews. And so when times get tough, the Jews begin to be looked at as the outsider. Who are these funny people? I've never met a Jew. And not only Jews, but of course African Americans, Catholics had it very rough in America, and minorities, immigrant minorities coming around the turn of the century, not only the Jews, but Eastern Europeans and Italians and all these newcomers were looked upon with some kind of a fear. So anti-Semitism is a part, as you point out, anti-Semitism is a part of a larger picture.
I found it fascinating and somehow not surprising once I thought about it that Reform Judaism started here.
Well, Reform Judaism didn't start here. It began in Germany, although you might have that impression. What we're trying to show in the series is that not only how Jews affected America, but how America affected the Jews. So when we look at the religion, we see that there's something that's called Judaism in the 19th century, which comes from Europe, and the traditional Judaism is, you know, Hebrew is the language that in which the whole worship service is done, and there are no organs in the synagogue. Well, what happens is that Reform Judaism says, wait a minute, we can change that and we can adapt it to America. So I see that there are sermons in English. My neighbors are having sermons in English. Let's have some English in our service too. My neighbors have organs. Why don't we have organs too? Jews don't in their traditional service, men and women don't mix. They don't sit in family pews. Jews said, let's have family seating. In fact, those who criticized the Reform Jews who wanted family seating called it promiscuous seating. So Reform Judaism adapts itself to life in America, and that is what the Jews do in general, in with their own lives and being here. They adjust to the American culture and society and American traditions.
And it's also interesting that even today, though, we still have room for the Orthodox.
Well, what's exciting to me is that today, all kinds of Jewishness thrives. I interviewed a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, who said to me that his father was an Orthodox rabbi in the 20s and thought he was the last of the Orthodox generation. He thought Orthodox Judaism, this traditional form of worship, would not survive. In fact, Orthodox Judaism is thriving, but so is Reform, so are all kinds of innovations in Judaism, because right now I think Jewish Americans feel extraordinarily free and optimistic, and there's a dynamism that among Jews that that is almost like a renaissance. Buddhism is coming into Jewish worship. That's being tried out, but that's not surprising because all kinds of innovations are being tried out in other religions. Orthodoxy is thriving. That's maybe not surprising either, because there's kind of a fundamentalism is thriving all over the world, and with Jews today, there are many ways of being Jewish, and bewildering at times.
Well, speaking of which, talk to us a little bit about Matisyahu.
Well, I was very excited to interview Matisyahu because, for me, this young man who is an Hasidic Jew and yet a genuine superstar, someone who combines reggae music with a hip-hop style and esoteric Jewish musing all in one, and performs in his Hasidic black hat and coat, he's the real thing. It's not an act. He's a very thoughtful man. He thinks carefully about his Judaism. He's glad to have a chance to offer up his thoughts. Yet he's so American. Where else but in America would you see all these forms combined in one, reaching out all over the country and all over the world, and connecting? That's exciting to me, and it says something about the nature of Jewishness today, that could happen.
Mr. Grubin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with filmmaker David Grubin about his new PBS series, The Jewish Americans. The three-part series will air on KET beginning Wednesday, January 9th. For more information, go to our website, WFPL.org, and click on Studio 619. Some year-end renovation work on one of Louisville's most beloved icons has uncovered a long-forgotten piece of history. The discovery occurred late last month aboard the Belle of Louisville riverboat. We asked Linda Harris, the Belle's chief executive officer, to share the good news with Studio 619. Give us a little background on this, Linda. How did you discover this little treasure on the Belle?
Well, it really started with our winter capital projects, where we were doing some upgrading that would remove some weight from the Belle because she's several tons overweight, as a lot of ladies get when they get older. And one of the things that we were going to do this year was remove her stage. As we were removing the stage, we found out that it had been a stage built on top of a stage built on top of a stage. So we were, one, very excited to find out that there was a lot of weight there to remove. But when we finally got them all taken out, the original floor from the 1914 vessel was in perfect shape underneath all the stages. And it was beautiful maple flooring. There was a little bit of glue on it, so it can be cleaned up beautifully. And it's probably about a 15 by 25 foot area that we intend to restore and keep for everyone to see.
So you say this dates back to 1914?
When the Idlewild was built. The Belle has had three lives. She was built as the Idlewild in 1914. Became the Avalon in 1948, became the Belle of Louisville in 1962.
So no one had any idea this piece of flooring was underneath?
Huh? No, we did not, because she was originally built as a packet boat, which is a boat to haul cargo and livestock and cars and some excursion passengers. But as she transpired through the years and changed her mission to stay alive, she was, remodeled and turned into different things, and one was an excursion boat, and there was a beautiful oak dance floor put down on the ballroom level of the Belle that exists today. And when that stage was built, they must have built over top of what was the original maple floor where the excursion part of the vessel was when she was built in 1914.
And you are going to preserve the floor? Will it remain where it is?
It will remain just in that area, yes. We don't know if the maple floor extends through the whole ballroom level because we won't be taking up the dance floor. But we will be preserving the area that we've uncovered.
And I assume she's made weight now, huh?
Well, she's lightening up as we go. We've removed two huge iron sewage tanks from her hull and are replacing them with polypropylene tanks, which are much lighter, doing several other things that will remove some weight from her.
Is she doing okay otherwise?
She is doing very well. We had a marine architect come in last year and do a total survey of the Belle, and they were amazed at the condition she's in for 93 years old. She'll be 100 in 2014. And they said that if we continue taking as good of care of her as she has been, she could easily see another 100 years.
Wow.
Which is far past our lives.
Well, Linda, thanks for talking with us, and congratulations on the find.
Thank you.
That was Linda Harris, Chief Executive Officer of the Belle of Louisville. The city-owned paddle wheeler, which is also a National Historic Landmark, is currently in dry dock, but will resume excursions in April. More information about the Belle can be found at our website, WFPL.org. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.